we feel a sigh of relief. Still, it cannot take away the pain. A measure of justice isn't the same as equal justice. This verdict brings us a step closer, and the fact is, we still have work to do. We still must reform the system. We are all a part of George Floyd's legacy. And our job now is to honor it and to honor him.
It was a murder in the full light of day, and it ripped the blinders off for the whole world to see. The systemic racism the Vice President just referred to. There was systemic racism that's a stain on our nation's soul. The guilty verdict does not bring back George. But through the family's pain, they're finding purpose. So George's legacy will not be just about his death, but about what we must do in his memory. I also spoke to Gianna, George's young daughter again. When I met her last year, I've said this before, at George's funeral, I told her how brave I thought she was. And I sort of knelt down to hold her hand. I said, Daddy's looking down on you, he's so proud. She said to me then, I'll never forget it, Daddy changed the world. I told her this afternoon, Daddy did change the world.
To Woke History. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I'm a college history professor in Washington, D.C. Woke History is a new podcast series that features lively conversations with guests, focusing on historical and contemporary issues of race, gender, political activism, and culture that are often ignored in most high school classrooms and social studies textbooks. Guests will include a wide range of individuals from scholars and community activists to professional athletes, media personalities, and others. Police brutality and racial profiling have always been significant issues within the African-American community. In recent years, social media, controversial police-related murders of black people, and the Black Lives Matter protests have brought these issues to the forefront. Today's episode, titled Trauma, looks at this topic from three different perspectives. Number one, policing. Two, the effects of over-policing on black mental health. And three, the role of the judicial system. I have several guests joining me. In the first segment, you'll hear from Dr. Lorenzo Boyd, a retired Boston police officer and the current Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at New Haven University. Dr. Christopher Bishop, the Chair of Psychology at Trinity Washington University. And also Reverend Dr. Cheryl McMillan and Reverend Daniel Graham, both from Metropolitan Baptist Church in Largo, Maryland. Let's begin our conversation.
So, Charlamagne the guy, who's a media personality, and he's also done a book on mental health because he himself suffers from anxiety, I believe. He says that he thinks all black people suffer from PTSD because of the effects of slavery and Jim Crow and, you know, just everything that's been happening. What do you think about that statement?
So I do disagree with that. I'm actually working on a book with policing right now on how to look at it. So you have to look at it from two perspectives, historical trauma. Okay. Historical trauma is we have always historically been traumatized in slavery. Okay. So this is just kind of what the state we're being in. It doesn't really meet DSM-5, what we call PTSD. It's more what we call complex trauma. Complex trauma usually is here in child abuse, but it's being repeatedly being exposed to a traumatic event. And it never stops for us through microaggression, through institutional racism. I mean, we're constantly are going to be exposed to this type of level of trauma. So it doesn't meet PTSD because in PTSD, somewhere it stops. It hasn't stopped for us. We're constantly being exposed to the television, through personal experience, at the workplace. So I look at it from that perspective.
Dr. Boyd, you want to jump in?
Yeah, not that I ever want to necessarily agree with Charlamagne the God, but a lot of what I see people of color are going through what I like to call vicarious trauma, that they don't necessarily have the experience with the police personally, but they see it over and over again. Every time they turn on social media or turn on the TV, they're saying black pain over and over and over again. And I don't think we're in post-traumatic stress disorder because we can't get to the post part because it's constant in a lot of the black community. And whether you're living middle-class suburban black or if you're living urban working-class black, you still see it and you still experience that level of pain. And the black community, I think, are going through the five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. We get through the denial part, not again, we're not seeing this again. And then we get into the anger part. Then that's when we start to see the protests, and sometimes it comes into riots. And then when we get to the bargaining is where we are right now today, on this date, right after George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor. But then when we see it again, that knocks us back into the anger stage. So a lot of times the black community is in a perpetual stage of anger because we continually see black pain over and over and over again. So we can't get to the post part of post-traumatic stress disorder because we're living in vicarious trauma.
Wow, and Danielle, I saw you shaking your head. You agree with that statement?
Yeah, I definitely agree that we're not in a post-state. And I think it's also compacted with the fact that most people of color do not even identify with the idea of trauma. You know, I noticed in my therapeutic sessions that, you know, when you start talking about trauma, you start talking about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. People don't seem to identify with the idea of trauma. They don't recognize that what they've experienced, what they're feeling, is even related to trauma. So they'll be, you know, really reticent to resist the term, resist that terminology. And so to even be able to acknowledge that we live in a perpetual state of traumatic experiences and overexposure, re-exposure, revictimization. We're experiencing so much trauma on a daily basis, we don't even recognize that's what it is too often.
And Reverend, yeah, I'm going to get you in. Reverend McMillan, you want to hop in?
Yeah, because I was, I just sort of piggyback on this whole anxiety issue. You know, I'm really sort of really concerned about this fear-based anxiety that continues to be about this whole fight, flight, freeze kind of a scenario. Particularly when you've got so many people now that are afraid of jogging, walking, barbecuing, sitting by the park, bird watching, minding their own business, you know. So what does this do to not only the individual, but to the families of individuals who are being traumatized, who are going through this sort of anxious state, living it out, and finding themselves not able to manage the anxiety that turns into anger that's sometimes projected onto to other people unnecessarily. So it's really, really just gotten to the point, I think, where we really have to give a lot more attention to this whole piece of how racial injustice really has impacted us from way back. And while the person that's, say, stopped by the police or accused of assaulting someone in a park when they're just bird watching, whatever that is, at that moment, we may not be thinking about 1619. But that historical context is now being played out in our current context. And the more things change, the more they stay the same. And I'm increasingly just sort of really, really concerned about the way our kids are looking at this, you know, especially our teenagers, our young African-American males especially. And then the women that have to get by, have to stand by and watch this happen without really not any power to do anything about it.
So, the media primarily focuses on the psychological impact of protests, police brutality, and the killings of unarmed minorities like Breonna Taylor on civilians. What impact, and I'm coming to you because I know you've had over a decade of actual experience in law enforcement, what impact do those activities have on the psyche of the individuals who are working in law enforcement? Like, how are the police impacted by what's taking place?
Well, let's unpack that a little bit, because before we can talk about policing protests, we have to talk about the negative training that police officers get. So when the police are in the academy, spending their 900 hours of their 6 months in the academy, they're taught in a militaristic style, the us versus them style. They're taught to view anyone who's not them as an other, the othering of America, particularly the othering of Black America. And then we understand in the ecology of crime that young people commit more crimes than old people, males commit more crimes than females, and population density increases levels of crime. So the person that's more likely to be criminal is young, urban, and male. Unfortunately, the term urban has been codified to be Black. So all of a sudden, Black males become the symbolic assailant, and that's how policing is trained. So if you go back historically to South Carolina, where policing started as slave patrols, and then you move policing forward into the Jim Crow era, and then you move policing through the civil rights era, then you move it right up to the stop and search. The way that the police are doing their job, they're taught to be warriors and not guardians. And then extra stress level on the police, because they're told that every stop could be your last stop. Every encounter could be your last encounter. Well, technically, this podcast could be our last podcast. So to say that people are overwhelmingly going to be victimized is not realistic, but we beat that into policing psyche. And last year was among the safest year for police since before the Nixon administration. We'd have to go back to the early 70s to see numbers as low as they are for police officers getting killed feloniously while on duty. But what we're not talking about when we talk about the war on crime, or the war on cops, the war predominantly is an internal war, because for the third year in a row, police suicide has outpaced police homicide. So it's not the symbolic assailant out there going to hurt the police. Most of the time, the harm is an internal harm. So when the police are out there dealing with protesters who are against the police, and they're listening to stuff, all this stuff weighs in on them. because we're training the police poorly and we're giving them bad information and all this stuff is going on the psyche. Now let's understand, in order to be a police officer in this country, you have to have earned a GED and reach 21 years of age. Well, not that I'm stepping into anybody else's world, but psychologically, the human brain doesn't stop developing until 25 or 26, but yet we can give a 21-year-old, imagine a gun and the ability to use force and deadly force, and to whom much is given, much is required. There's a lot on them. And then policing is really authoritative. It's do as I say. It's I walk in because I say something, you're supposed to do it. But unfortunately, that's not the reality of policing, because legitimacy is earned, not taken. And a lot of police officers are walking into communities where they don't understand the norms and the mores. They don't understand cultural competence, and they're walking in thinking they can run roughshod over people's lives. Unfortunately, people have been backed into the corner, and then they're fighting back. So now the police are dealing with the level of stress because they're not trained to deal with this, because in 905 hours, which is an average police academy, they do between 80 and 100 hours with the firearm, they do about 40 hours driving, they do another 20 hours defensive tactics, and they do four hours of verbal de-escalation. So when it's time to have a confrontation, you're gonna go back to muscle memory. That's why police officers default to the firearm, because we train them so much with the firearm. If we can train the police a little differently to be more proactive, then we can cut down on a lot of the trauma that they're feeling.
Dr. Boyd, there's like so many questions that are popping into my head as you're talking, because my best friend is a cop. He's a cop in D.C., and he's actually in a cop family where his wife is a police officer, his mother-in-law is a police officer, brother-in-law is a police officer. You know, they're all cops. And we have these conversations, and I asked them, I was like, well, if you get more people of color doing the training, you know, and getting, you know, cops prepared at the academy level, will that make a difference? And his response was no, because at the end of the day, everybody's using the same outdated curriculum. So it doesn't matter who's doing the training if the curriculum's outdated, if the curriculum's wrong. And then he also said that there's not a universal curriculum per se that everybody necessarily uses. So what they're trained working in D.C. or Capitol Police may look different from somebody in New York or somebody down south or elsewhere. So that's one thing I wanted to bring up. But then also, you talked about how cops have like this authoritative, attitude, right? You know, and we hear that whole shoot to kill mentality, and people always say, well, how come they can't just shoot them in the knee? And, you know, cops will say, well, that's not how we're trained in the academy. Like, you have to shoot here, you know, to kill the person, right? But how what happens? So I see, okay. So is that not correct? You don't have to shoot to kill?
No, that's, in my pet peeve, let's unpack that a little bit.
Good, let's do that.
Not taught to shoot to kill. There's no police academy in this country that will ever say shoot to kill. Okay. Because if so, then you've got some legal liability that you have to deal with. You are taught to shoot to stop the available threat, and you're taught to shoot center mass. Now, people that are listening on the podcast, put your hand on one side of your torso and the other side. Look at the amount of space between your hands. And then people will say, well, why didn't you shoot the gun out of the hand? Look at the size of your hand versus the size of your torso. You own that bullet until it stops. Am I more likely to hit somebody in the largest part of them or in their hand or in their knee? So the police are taught to shoot center mass because you don't want bullets whizzing past people and taking out grandmothers or little kids or something. So it's not shoot to kill. It's shoot to stop the available threat.
Are police officers, you said that the problem of police homicide, police suicide, is actually worse than police homicide. So are police mandated to get mental health counseling or therapy? interviewers that absolutely only after they've shot someone?
Absolutely not. They are not. There's only 10% of all police departments in this country that have any sort of suicide prevention mandates. It's the exact opposite. Most of them aren't talking about it and aren't expected to talk about it. Because the one thing that's going to happen, if I decide to go to Dr. Bishop and say, I'm having these feelings, the very first thing they're going to determine is, are you a threat? They're going to take your sidearm away. So taking the gun away from the police is like taking wings from a bird. Nobody wants to even go through that. So they're going to suppress it. They're going to internalize it. They're not going to talk about it. And unfortunately, it's going to come out in a really bad situation. And most police departments aren't dealing with that. And as a matter of fact, NYPD, largest police department in the nation, they're averaging one suicide per month. And that's going on almost 2 years. One per month. They're certainly not averaging one homicide of police officers getting killed per month. That's not happening at all. So we need to pay attention to the mental health, not only of the community, but the people that are sworn to protect and serve the community.
And it just seems like it's a powder keg almost, where you get a community of people who feel over-policed, right? Black and brown people who feel over-policed, so they're on edge, right? Reverend Mack really talked about the women, you know, when the stress that, you know, they're dealing with seeing their sons and husbands and lovers, you know, being abused. And then you're bringing in these cops who are feeling on edge and they're not getting the proper psychological help that they need. And then I also want to throw in, if you're a minority cop, like my best friend, you know, you got people calling you Uncle Tom, sellout. You know, like he was experiencing that during the protest when he was in D.C. People were saying he's the enemy, and he's like, hey, I'm on your side, but, you know, I have a job to do, so I can't do anything. But, I mean, it just seems like it's ripe for something bad to happen, and I'm not trying to excuse what's taking place, but it just seems like the circumstances are there for nothing but, you know, trouble to take place. Reverend Mack, you want to jump in?
I just wanted to ask a question of Dr. Ford. If I'm hearing you right, there's nothing within, set up in the police department itself that could really address the needs of an officer that they see needs some intervention in that area. Am I hearing that right?
For the most part, most departments have employee assistance programs, but it's voluntary.
Yeah.
And it's also, the other problem is, police departments that have strong unions protect their officers. They protect even bad cops. They protect cops who in order to avoid getting them taken off the street. So, you know, full disclosure, I was a shop steward, I was a union president. I'm a big fan of organized labor, but I understand the problem of police unions in getting bad cops off the street or dangerous cops off the street.
Dr. Boyd, so now you're in the world of academia. Like, what are some of the things that you're doing at the university level to try to fix this problem in terms of policing?
I've been training police officers now for about 20 years, and some years I do between 200 and 250 hours per year of training the police. I've done a paradigm shift. When I was the director of the Center for Advanced Policing, we gave up on the notion of building a better cop. That's passé. What we do is get people interested in policing, and we give them four skills. We give them empathy, we give them compassion, we give them critical thinking skills, and we give them communication skills. We're looking for a holistic approach, because that's what's missing in police training. A holistic approach, training the person and not just the robot being a cop. So if you can train a person to understand the issues of other people. So when we do training, we bring community members in, particularly sometimes justice-involved people and young people, because we want the police to understand lived experience of the people that they're policing. We want them to be able to empathize. Once you arrest somebody, let's look at what happens. Let's talk about that, what happens to that person, not just in the criminal justice system, but let's talk about what happens psychologically to that person that's now locked up. And let's talk about the family that's left behind. Because when a person is arrested, it's kind of like an arrest for the whole family. And the problem is the police are reactive. Upwards of 90% of policing is reactive. They look for crime once it happened. And the problem is that we should be focusing on crime, because crime is not the problem. Crime is symptomatic of larger problems in society. let's look at why these crimes happen. Let's look at the substance abuse. Let's look at joblessness. Let's look at under education. Let's look at transiency. Let's look at homelessness. Look at the things that cause crime, the homelessness, the addiction, the lack of education, the joblessness. If we address those issues, the crime rates will take care of themselves, because crime is not the problem. Crime is symptomatic of larger problems, and if we address those issues, we won't need the police to be warriors. Then they can be guardians and protecting the people in the community.
Hold on, Doc.
Okay. Dr. Boyd, you and I have to connect after this, because that's actually, I'm writing a chapter on this discussion. Part of my practice is that we do fitness evaluation and evaluations for police officers. And so I'm actually writing a chapter right now about what the issues about policing is, the training and assessment. Because when we do psychological assessments to look at police candidates, we're using personality assessments. We're not looking at how they're looking at culture or implicit biases. We're not looking at any of that. We're just looking at these standardized testing that all the police departments are getting, but that's not what is making a good candidate. So part of my chapter, and again, we're going to talk after this, is looking at how do we do better with assessment training. In some countries, police officers are trained for 2 years before they can actually go out into the field. And going back to you, Dr. Boyd, there are some changes. Like, for example, in Virginia, and I think it's Fairfax, they do critical incident reporting. So they actually are hiring psychologists to do this. So when a police officer shoots someone, they have to go and talk to the police officer to make sure that they're okay. So it's not punitive. It's making sure that we get them back to where they can be an effective police officer. So... Oh, I'm excited by your conversation, because everything you talk about is in my chapter.
In this next segment, I continue the discussion on the psychological effects of over-policing on the Black community. My guests for segment two are Dr. Kendell Jasper and his brother, Kanan Jasper. The Jaspers, better known as Doc and the Dude, are the co-founders of Jasper Psychological Services. In addition to serving the general public, they also counsel professional athletes in the NBA and the NFL, and they could be seen on various syndicated television series such as Sway in the Morning and The Breakfast Club.
So the big story right now on social media and national news in general is the police shooting of Walter Wallace Jr., the young Black man in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, right? And then the social unrest has followed since that shooting. And this might be the eighth or tenth story that's made national headlines since May of 2020. So what are the long-term effects on the youth who see this mayhem on social media almost every week, sometimes on a daily basis?
Well, you say what's done to the youth. I'm not young anymore, but I do have two young sons, and I asked them about that, so I got to dig into them to answer that. They're frustrated, and they're confused, and it's good why they're confused, because they're looking at me and what I've taught them. I've taught them, if somebody hits you, you hit them back, you knock the shit out of them, you go back at them as hard as you can. And they expect that reaction. They're gonna expect it from me as their first protector, and then they're gonna react a certain way too. So they're confused, like, why isn't nobody doing anything back? And I think that's what many youth who have courage, they're gonna be like, look, I want to do something back. That's gonna be the ultimate reaction. That's the only fair reaction. As far as I'm concerned, I'm like, you. If somebody does something to you, you have to react or respond in some sort of way that won't let them do it to you again. Now, what that looks like, it looks like a lot of things. You know, it could look like an organized approach that solidifies us and unites us so that it's not that easy to do it, and heighten our awareness of all our surroundings and our opposition's capabilities, so you know how to deal with them appropriately. Or it could be a knee-jerk reaction of a retaliation. So you're dealing with emotions, and they're justifiable, all of them. So hopefully we deal with it with an organized way, not to dissipate the emotion, but to direct them in a way that's going to be effective and most effective. And some of the things that I see, is, I don't think it's that effective.
Did you ever, like, tell your sons, hey, put down the social media, because that, you know, it might be too much, like, this is, like, just seeing these people getting shot constantly, you know, this might be too much for you to take right now?
I tell them, you know, sometimes you still need to watch that, because what you're consuming is going to have an effect on you, and you don't know where it might come out. You don't know what might trigger your emotions or your frustration. So, yeah, I'll tell them.
It's secondary trauma, right? Yeah. So although I'm not experienced in it firsthand, I'm watching it. And if I'm consistently watching something, you know, you're consistently watching violence, you're consistently listening to music that has violent themes, it plays out in a way. Either you become hypersensitive to it or you become fully desensitized to it somewhere on the spectrum. And none of those places on the extreme is a very good place to be, right? We should have some compassion, some empathy, some understanding of the things that are going on and have appropriate emotional reactions to them, right? Some of that is going to create emotional reactions that most of us would agree aren't going to be appropriate, right? It absolutely is going to have an impact in the same way that, you know, other things have an impact. You know, if you think about what we watch on TV, right, how many marketing ad dollars go into products, right, and how they're marketed and how often we see these things or how often we hear them to create some form of reaction to make us want to purchase a product, to make us like a song, right? Just imagine that same mechanism that's occurring with real life events that are heinous, that are occurring where we're the target. We're consistently getting gunned down by the police, and it's made available for public consumption. What do you think your reaction to the police are gonna be? Right? What do you think? What's your immediate thought when you come in contact with any form of law enforcement? You know, you're instantly in a frantic kind of state, right? The immediate thought is, I don't feel safe. I don't say, oh my God, I'm glad the police are here. Everything's gonna be okay. To a certain degree, what I'm saying is, I don't know what's gonna happen. Like, I may be an innocent bystander and may get pulled into a situation just because of the color of my skin and how I'm viewed as a threat.
Brothers, before we get too much deeper into this conversation, because we touched on a lot and we got a lot more we're going to touch on, but before we get too deep into it, can you all just tell the audience just a little bit about yourselves and how you got to, you know, where you currently are right now? In terms of being mental health experts?
Well, I'll start. I'm Kane and Jasper. I'm the dude portion of the Doc and the Dude. And I'm not going to call myself a mental health expert. I think that would be irresponsible and careless when I have my brother, who's Dr. Jasper, sitting right here. I've surely learned a lot. I've studied a lot. And I'm still learning. But I wouldn't call myself an expert. But how we got here, I basically follow the lead of my brother. My youngest brother basically brought mental health and the practice of it to our family. You know, the this was his path. And it obviously, I had never heard anybody explain it the way he was explaining it. So it drew me in further. You know, my everyday is this marketing, advertising arm with a education background of electrical engineering. So, you know, but we were always rooted in community, stemming from our parents, stemming from the love that our grandmother had in the neighborhood and stuff like that. But as far as leading to the mental health spot and being more specific there, it definitely came from Ken Delton blazing a trail that we didn't even see before.
Yeah, so like my brother said, my name is Dr. Kendall Jasper. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I've been practicing since 04. You know, we came to this out of a private practice that I started in 2004 that mushroomed into a more comprehensive mental health agency. And, you know, certainly with the circles that my brother's in, and on the other side of it, his background in marketing and brand management and sponsorship, getting to know a lot of folks, getting to learn their stories, having more and more discussions about the importance of bringing the message about mental health to the masses. And then, of course, you know, having a strong sports and entertainment background, finding ourselves now in a space where we're doing a lot of work with, you know, sports organizations and various companies, you know, and getting on different platforms to talk about that mental health message. So, you know, it's a nice space to be in, of course, because it's something that, you know, I can talk all day about, very passionate about it. And I think that some of that passion has spilled over into, you know, Kanan's discussion, you know, or Kanan's realm, you know, about the importance of us understanding, you know, our own mental health.
Did either one of you ever have mental health issues, or did people close to you in your family deal with mental health issues at all?
I think every black person has mental health issues. You know, and that's one of the reasons why I became drawn to it, because you start seeing things within yourself. And you're like, wow, I could use some help there. Because, I mean, how many conversations have you had growing up where somebody said, look, let's have them assess, let's do a self-assessment, you know? You know, you go to the doctor, you get a physical checkup. Why wouldn't you go get a mental checkup? Why wouldn't you? That's the most important thing you have going on is your mind. So why wouldn't we go get a mental checkup or see how it best works or how it best works for you? So, yeah, I mean, personally, I had some struggles. You know, we lost some loved ones, and we've seen a lot of trauma growing up where we grew, you know, where we were raised. And it played, hell yeah, it plays a mental trick on you. You become hyper aggressive sometimes. So yeah, we've had some issues. I've had some issues for sure.
Yeah, you know, I was watching the old interview you guys did, and I think you were saying how when you were a kid, was somebody like encouraging you to like fight somebody else or something?
Yeah.
Like, can you tell that story real quick?
Yeah, this is a public school. This is an elementary school. We had a gym teacher. You know, after recess, we come into like the waiting area, the auditorium for the teachers to come pick us up. And this dude would orchestrate gladiator type fights every day. He would pick two young black men and pair them against each other. And we would rumble every day in front of the whole school. And then at the end, he would hold one hand up and like, people would cheer for the winner. They boo the loser, you know what I mean? And I thought that was normal. But the area, you gotta understand too, the area we grew up in was extremely, extremely rough. The school we went to was in the middle of about 7 housing projects, and then houses spring in between. So you had conflict every day, but he orchestrated that. He played on that, and you know. just par for the course.
Yes, yeah. Where did you guys grow up?
Huh?
Where did you grow up? Like, what city?
Brooklyn, East New York, Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
So once again, that was Dr. Kendall Jasper and his brother Kanan. For this final segment, I'm joined by acclaimed trial attorneys Dante Mills Esquire, Lennon Edwards Esquire, and Gary Bailey Jr. Esquire. Mr. Mills and Mr. Lennon are the co-founding partners of the law firm Mills and Edwards LLP in New York City. Mr. Bailey is the founding partner of Bailey and Associates, located in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They'll be discussing the role that the courts and attorneys play in many of these police-involved shootings. They're also going to be talking about how they also experience much of the same trauma that many of the people they represent in court deal with when it comes to interactions with police officers.
The name Breonna Taylor national rallying cry for those demanding changes in American policing. Protests and celebrities speaking out.
We feel for and we want justice.
Say her name, Breonna Taylor.
Beyonce is demanding justice for Breonna Taylor.
But unlike George Floyd, Eric Garner, or Rayshard Brooks, there's no video capturing the final moments of her life.
Do you know Breonna Taylor's story, her whole story?
Today, a Times investigation pieces together what actually happened to Breonna Taylor. In part one, Rukmini Kalamaki tells the story of how police ended up at her door. It's...
Okay, so the audio clip for the audience listening, the audio clip you just heard was from the New York Times podcast, The Killing of Breonna Taylor. And that was the first episode of that podcast series. So anybody who wants to learn more about that case, I would definitely recommend you check that out. And then there's a good documentary that the Times has as well that's available on Hulu. And you can watch that. It's only 50 minutes, so it's not a long watch. But fellas, I played that because this was one of the cases that really dominated the news and social media and conversations throughout 2020. And I just wanted to get your opinion about the case and what happened, what didn't happen in terms of the punishment for the police officers.
Well, I can tell you that the punishment for the police officers was not for the killing of Breonna Taylor. It was for endangering people in the apartment next to hers. So when we talk about Black Lives Matter, and we've had this conversation before where we talk about just generally, when I say we, I mean Lennon, Gary, myself, I mean the general public, we talk about Black Lives Matter and what that means. What it means is things are going to happen. We cannot prevent the police officers from killing another Black person. That's just the blunt, honest truth. It's going to happen again because there's a perception that we are more dangerous. And until we control that narrative and take away that perception, a police officer is going to show up, believe that we are more dangerous than anybody else and that his life is in danger, and they're going to act. It's going to happen again, unfortunately. But when things happen, there has to be consequences for it. That's what Black Lives Matter means. Not preventing Black people from getting killed, because it's impossible. But when things happen, people have to be held accountable. And in the Breonna Taylor case, they weren't. No officer is in jail for killing Breonna Taylor, although she was in her home and had not broken any rules, right? But then, the only consequence that came down is that they endangered people in the apartment next to hers because they blindly shot into her apartment, and some of those bullets went into the apartment next door, which means they were shooting without an actual target, which is a violation of police protocol. But Breonna Taylor's life didn't matter enough for that danger that not only existed, but that actually turned into her death to be punishable. And that's a problem. That's what Black Lives Matter means, and that's what it has to mean, that when something happens, you will be punished, and it's not determined that it's okay to do what you did because it was a black person that probably was dangerous anyway. That's what has to be changed.
So my understanding is there were discrepancies that really there were no consequences for. And it's a discrepancy when an officer says that he announced himself and someone's saying that he didn't. There's a discrepancy when a warrant is completed with information in it that's not actually true, but they did it anyway. It should never be that we have a legal process or a law enforcement process where information is put into an instrument that allows the police to do something that they should never have had a right to do. Officers who don't tell the truth, who don't give an accurate account about what actually took place, and get to walk away like nothing happened, when they escape responsibility and are allowed to escape responsibility, that's a problem. We can't prevent black deaths, but we need to deter them. We need to shorten that list of names. We need to have a system in place that is supposed to work for everyone. Because if it's not working for everyone, then it's not a system. It's a sentence. It's a death sentence. It's a death sentence in every area of our lives. And that's what her case represents, that there has to be change. And it can't just be that we sing about her. It can't just be that we talk about her. We have to make those laws change and make those officers and everyone, not just the officers, the judge who signed. I mean, the whole system has to be accountable for what takes place. Our lives do matter, and they will continue to matter, and they have to be treated like they matter.
So one of the things that I think we have to start doing is really forcing the issue of reality versus perception. FBI statistics show that officers are 6 times more likely to be shot by a white assailant than a black assailant. That's a fact, okay? So this idea that these officers fear for their life or in danger, well, I can never take their shoes, I'm willing to say I don't buy it, because there's nothing to suggest that it's the truth when they are training professionals that are trained based on theory, statistics, and everything else. So the bottom line is, they're not a threat when it comes to black men and black women. So once you take that part, now you add to the level that there's no fear of retribution. So let me speak for what I deal with. So for all the civil rights cases that I've done, okay, which have been, you know, dozens, I've only personally seen 2 officers get prosecuted. Not necessarily because of the case that I was dealing with, but because 2 officers directly come to mind that were caught up in wide-scale corruption throughout the police force. And really what it comes down to is the people... The people in power, okay, the majority has to have some outrage and want things to change, right? Now, because they don't look like us and don't live our lives, it's hard for them to be empathetic and have outreach. But here's where they can have empathy and outreach. When the city of, you know, Philadelphia or the city of Ferguson or the city of Chicago pays out a civil rights case, guess where that money's coming from? It's coming from taxpayers' money. When you have Officer John Smith or Officer so-and-so get arrested for falsifying records or planting evidence or perjury, guess what happens? Now the district attorney has to go back and look at all the cases that Officer Detective Smith sat on and, you know, gave testimony or submitted evidence on, and a lot of those cases now get overturned. So people now are walking the street again who they may consider, you know, a detriment or a menace to society, whatever the case may be. So that's where the majority can start to get outraged, because they look at it as, well, one black life doesn't matter. Okay, if that's how you feel, what about the millions of dollars that's coming out of taxpayers' money that you pay, and now the people that, you know, innocent or not, who were locked up are now back on the street, or the damage to the system again, through taxpayer monies that's going on. Until that starts to change, the narrative that somehow we are a threat and that our lives are meaningless is going to continue to keep going. And that's what has to happen. The majority has to have an outreach. You can't blame the victim. And as the victim, how do you change the system? It has to be the people in power. Okay, they have the badge, they have the gun, they have the power of independent legislation to take away this veil of secrecy. They have to take away blue coat of silence. They have to take away qualified immunity. There has to be retribution and punishment for people that break the law across the board.
There has to be, but I don't think we should settle for the reason for it being because taxpayers have to pay money or anything. We have to speak up until the reason for the change is because, in fact, we do matter. I don't think we should let them off the hook and say, all right, you don't really care that one black person died, but you understand that they're going to have to pay the family a couple million dollars and that may come out of your pocket. I don't think we give them that out. We force it down their throats. And every time we witness injustice, we do whatever our part is to spread the word about it. As attorneys, our part is taking up these civil rights cases, which we do. And in fact, we just had officers in New York indicted for excessive force. And as Gary said, it's very rare, but we are pushing that and making sure that we change that fact. If you're in a general public and your role could be showing up to a protest, your role can be telling people or having conversations with people who don't know the experience of black lives, you know, so that they're enlightened. Whatever your role is, you have to force it down our throats and not allow them to accept us being inferior or saying that, you know, I don't really care about this black life, but it is sad that the city, the taxpayers have to pay this money. No, we have to make it known that this is the reason, and the reason is because we matter. We're not accepting any other excuse. So,
can you all just really briefly just explain the difference for the listeners between a trial jury versus a grand jury? Because we always hear that term grand jury brought up in cases like the Breonna Taylor situation.
Well, a grand jury, if the easiest way to look at it is grand jury is like a pre-screening process. So you have a much larger panel, generally 30, 40, a much larger panel of people who hear the facts of a case, but only from the side of the prosecutor or district attorney. And that prosecutor or district attorney decides what he wants to tell the jury and how he wants to explain the case to them. And they determine from hearing what the prosecutor or district attorney presents to them, whether or not there's a basis or reason for this case to move forward with whatever the charges are. So it's almost a screening process. The problem with that process is as I just stated, the district attorney or prosecutor, they're the ones who feed the information. So they can choose to not say, and let's use Breonna Taylor's case specifically, they can choose to say that, oh, the officer testified or will testify or gave a statement that he knocked first. And they don't have to say that there were two other witnesses who said that they didn't hear a knock and announce. Right? They don't have to say that. So that grand jury, those screeners, if they only hear the officer saying that he did, then they're going to say, well, clearly there was a knock and announce, right? So that's the problem. When you get to a trial jury hears the arguments from both sides. So the prosecutor gets to put what he wants to in front of that trial jury, but so does the defendant at that point. And then the defendant's attorney can then call witnesses to counter whatever the prosecutor is saying. And then the jury decides after knowing all of the facts that both sides think they need to know. But that's at the trial stage. The grand jury is a pre-screening where they may not hear all the evidence, and that's part of what's happened and what's come out in the Breonna Taylor case. There's been some information that there were a lot of things that were not told to the grand jury when they made those decisions.
All three of you are highly successful lawyers. Very educated, you know, make good money. But my question is, do you all still feel anxious and uncomfortable when you're walking outside if you're not wearing a suit and a tie? Like, do you still have that feeling of angst that so many black men and black feel when you see a police officer, or just in general?
No, I don't. Okay. So I'm very aware of my surroundings and my skin, but I'm very comfortable and confident in who I am. And I'm sure Dante and Leonard back us up. We're at a point to where we never forgot where we come from. We are closely attached to our community, our family, so we're comfortable walking and existing in any part, you know, of the city and in the area, because we don't feel above anyone nor beneath anyone. Now, when you're talking about law enforcement, that's a very specific encounter. So when I see an officer on the street, I look at him just as an officer on the beat doing his job. If I see a cop drive past me, I don't get nervous. The only instance to where my antenna goes up is when those lights flash and they pull me over, because now we're dealing with an encounter to where he has a gun and a badge of power, or she has a gun and a badge of power, and I have to keep in my mind, be at peace, de-escalate, you know, just comply with respect and dignity. You know, you don't want anything to happen to you that would dehumanize you, but you certainly have to make sure that the encounter moves as quickly as possible, you get home to your family. So it's be comfortable, be confident, but never not be aware of what's around and what's going on as life is progressing. Because as a black man, we know that that means something and something different to everyone.
I do. I do. I feel uncomfortable at times. I'll give you a specific example. I had a dream car, right? And thankfully, we're successful enough that I bought it. And one of the first things I did was blacked out the windows. Not because I think 10 is cool, but because I know that every time I lock eyes in that car, because I didn't tint out the front, every time I lock eyes with an officer in that car, I get pulled over. That's just the reality. So I take steps to avoid that. Now, Gary's absolutely correct, and I back him that, you know, we know enough that I'm not going to challenge an officer, but I also want to avoid those confrontations as much as possible. So I do take steps to not have those encounters, because I know that those encounters can go sideways. And the fact that I'm educated, the fact that, you know, we are successful, I'm not immune to that. You know, we have children. We have a case with an 8-year-old boy who suffered, you know, a racist episode. So, and he's just a child. So you can be a child, you can be a lawyer, you can be an old man, a young man, it doesn't matter. There's no immunity from people judging you because of the color of your skin and assuming that you're more dangerous because of the color of your skin. So I absolutely take steps to avoid confrontations with officers, because I know that there's a chance that it won't end well, despite the fact that I'm well spoken.
I definitely am dress conscious. That said, when I don't have on a suit, I dress down all the way down as much as possible. And I stay local. If I have to leave the neighborhood, then I definitely am definitely more concerned. I feel safe, but I feel in danger. I feel safe, but I feel like I'm targeted. And it's not just the cops. 2020, black and you dress down, you still get followed in stores. We have a client who walked past the store. Somebody else stole something, just walked past the store and ended up being arrested. There's still situations where just being black, sleeping while black, driving while black, shopping while black, living in your own apartment while black, you are still a target. So it's important to be aware. Like Gary said, it's important to take steps, like Dante said. But at a certain point, it's like, come on. I definitely feel like things need to change.
Yeah, and one of the things, you know, Joshua, is interesting is my entire life, the only encounters I've had with police have been for minor traffic violations. But it wasn't until I became an attorney, have a temple law on my license plate, that I was ever arrested and put in handcuffs for suspicion of DUI, which was completely bogus. So I was told very quickly that just because I'm a lawyer and just because I have a suit on, that my blackness supersedes that in a matter of an instance. And I can be treated just as disrespectfully and disregarded as anyone, you know, without any regard for my, you know, my profession or what I've accomplished. So again, it's something that I'm always going to be aware of, but it's certainly always going to be balanced out with trying to make sense of it all and live comfortable enough that you don't become a prisoner in your own skin and in your own environment.
Do you all have children?
Yes, I have a son who's 12 and a daughter who just turned 16. And if your next, if part B of your question is gonna be, what do we tell them?
Yeah.
we tell them to make it home. Yeah. We're terrified for them and it shouldn't be the case. I remember my mother, I'll tell you about this quickly, I was in college, so I'm an honor student, I'm a Division I athlete, I'm not running around the streets because I'm always either practicing or studying. And I'm stopped at a traffic light in a 1973 Plymouth Valley, nothing flashy like Dante had, right? In front of me is a cop car stopped at the light. Behind me is my mother and my dad in the, I don't know, 1990-something vehicle. I jump out of the car at the light, run to my parents' car to get an umbrella. I'm now walking back to the car. The two cops get out of their cars, guns drawn, and they're coming towards me. I have an umbrella in my hand, not a gun, not a Uzi, an umbrella. And if my mother didn't come running out of the car screaming, "That's my son, that's my son," I might not be here today. So, are we terrified for our kids? Yes, because even when we weren't doing anything, we're still a target. We're still in danger. And we try to tell them, you know, follow the officer's instructions. Don't try to win in that moment. Ask for your lawyer. Don't say anything that's incriminating. Ask for a lawyer. Make sure it's heard. Make sure it's stated before you do anything. Ask a lawyer. Ask the officer, I need to reach for something in the car. It's in this particular place. May I do that? I mean, walk them through what you're doing so they can see your hands at all times. We try to give them survival skills, but it doesn't change the fact that we're terrified for them when they walk out the door.
Yeah, I have a son and a daughter as well. My son has already had multiple encounters with police officers where he was targeted. One where he was with a group of about 15 boys, and it happened to be him and another black young man. They were walking in the neighborhood, being boys, making loud noise and, you know, that kind of thing. The officers show up, and out of the 15, there's two black boys. They pull those two black boys out of the group and begin to interrogate them. And that happened when my son was 13 years old. So he's already had those encounters. And again, like Lena said, what I have to tell him is to make it home. And this goes for everybody. I mean, you're not going to win a battle with an officer at 2 in the morning when he's pulled you over on the side of the road. You're not going to win that battle. So why pick that as your battleground? You comply. You say, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. You get home. And then if you're outraged, if you feel it was inappropriate, if it was improper, if it was racist, then you decide what your next move is when you're on your home field. You go to social media. You go to the news. You tell... you want to report the officer. Whatever you do, do it on your own terms because you are not going to win that battle against that officer in that moment. And that's something that we have to have drilled into our heads. I'm not telling you to, and I don't tell my son to just accept everything lying down because that's not who we are.
Yeah.
But we're also wise enough to pick our battlegrounds and where we choose to take our stand. And 2 in the morning on the side of the road is not where you do that. So the advice I give to my son is to just be mindful. And I tell him, I don't want you to not do something because of someone, how someone may perceive you. And if I go back to the example of the car that I have, I could have chosen not to buy that car because it gets attention and it may get me pulled over. But I wanted it. So I got it anyway. Now I took precautions and put the tent. And I also recognize that I may get pulled over, which I do often, because I have it. But I also have to be wise enough in those situations to pick my battles. So I tell my son to be mindful. When he's walking, just recognize that you may be singled out because they're going to have preconceived notions and ideas about who you are. But just be ready for that mentally, that you can deal with the moment and then choose when and how to fight.
our show for the week. Special thanks to all of today's guests, Dr. Lorenzo Boyd, Dr. Christopher Bishop, Reverend Daniel Graham, Reverend Dr. Cheryl McMillan, Dr. Kendall Jasper, Mr. Kanan Jasper, Dante Mills Esquire, Lennon Edwards Esquire, and Gary Bailey Jr. Esquire. And also, prayers go out to the families of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Trayvon Martin, Ahmaud Arbery, Mike Brown, Sandra Bland, Jacob Blake, Dante Wright, and anyone else who has been the victim of unnecessary violence. If you like what you heard, please check out future episodes. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.